for Memphis in the morning. I gotta get past Jackson by the break of day.
We continue our series of programs on those physical traces of the past that have special meaning to a group of well-known American historians that were included in the book American Places, published by Oxford University Press.
I'd like to welcome Kenneth Jackson to Talking History. Jackson is the Jacques Burzon Professor of History and Social Sciences at Columbia University. He's also the author of one of the chapters in American Places on Main Street, Memphis, Tennessee. Welcome, Professor Jackson.
Well, I'm glad to be here, Brian.
Why the personal interest in Memphis?
Well, there was a quotation that my mother used to put over my bed by Abraham Lincoln that said, "I'd like to see a man who's proud of the place where he's from, and I'd like to see the place proud of the man." And I've always felt that, you know, you can't disconnect history from geography, that place makes a difference. And you can't change where you're from, but I think that you might as well be loyal to it. And I've always felt that there's a part of Memphis or part of my southern heritage in me, even though I've been gone for four decades now.
So you grew up there and have a personal interest.
I do. I have three sisters who still live there. I go there often. Of course, it's quite a contrast to New York City, but I think there's just an awful lot that's wonderful and lovely about Memphis.
What about professional interest? You've written on a wide range of topics, Ku Klux Klan, suburbanization. Any connection there with Memphis?
Well, only two. Was when I was looking for a PhD dissertation, a professor at what was then called Memphis State and now the University of Memphis suggested that I work on the Ku Klux Klan. And I had heard the name, and I knew it had an association with Memphis, and actually one of the chapters in that book, which was called The Ku Klux Klan in the City, dealt with Memphis. And so in that sense, there was a strong connection between where I grew up and my professional interest. But then I left it. And even though when I later wrote Crabgrass Frontier about the suburbanization of the United States, I had a few references to Memphis, but I would say that Memphis did not loom large in the story. It was not until I was asked to write about my personal intersection with history that I chose once again to think about Main Street in Memphis and the way in which shopping malls and shopping centers have so completely changed the way people live in the last 40 years.
You subtitled your piece for American Places, The Rise and Fall of Main Street. So you're applying it here at a larger level. The very idea of Main Street is important, and you talk about that in your article. Explain this whole concept of Main Street for us.
Well, there was a time, actually, I think for about a century, between, let's say, 1860 and 1960, or let's think of it as the time of the streetcar, when all roads went to Main Street. If you were in Omaha, Nebraska, or Boston, Massachusetts, or Spokane, Washington, and you, before the era of the automobile, or really as late as the 1940s, and you boarded a form of public transportation, often the streetcar, it took you to Main Street. And so there was, even though people moved out to the suburbs, there was still a kind of a connection to the center, because the public transit system required that you go to the center in the same way that the automobile almost discourages you from going to the center because you need to park it. And so the automobile encourages lateral movement or even outward movement, where public transit encourages inward movement. So what I was really writing about there is the way that the automobile and the expressway and the shopping mall have changed the way we live. And in a way, it was a regrettable thing. I think that people have lost a lot with the loss of Main Street. And what I was writing about there was what it was like as a 10-year-old to take a bus downtown and how exciting downtown was. It had an edge to it. Not only were there department stores and movie theaters, but there were magazine stores. There was a variety that you would never find in even the largest shopping mall in the world, because shopping malls are all controlled by a single force. And if they think your magazines you're selling are not quite proper, or that you need to be open on a Sunday and you want to be closed, or you want to stay open and they say you should be closed. In other words, and you can't, you know, distribute flyers. It's private property. And in a way, that article was about why downtown was exciting and why it was such a wonderful thing. And I think what Americans have lost with the decline of downtown.
Okay, let's be more specific there, but let's start by having you give us just a very brief description of what Memphis was like when you were a child.
Well, Memphis was a city of several hundred thousand people, almost equally divided between black and white, not very much ethnic diversity, but a city in which there was, at least in Main Street, a kind of coming together. Now, I don't want to be Pollyannish about it. Obviously, it was a segregated city. But where else in the city would whites and blacks stand at the same shopping counter or in the same line but at a department store? Because the movie theaters were segregated, the restaurants were segregated. Everything was segregated about the city. And it really was... The time I grew up, which was early in the 1950s, was a period of prosperity after the Second World War. It was an automobile culture, but an automobile culture that still allowed. It had not really killed off the department stores and downtown movie theaters yet.
You mentioned department stores and automobiles and trolley cars, but in your article you give, I think, a very nice, almost literary description coming in, if you will, into the heart of the city and what you notice as you go down Main Street. Recall some of that for us. What comes to mind when you think of Main Street, Memphis?
Well, I think just the trip going there was a kind of a freedom with public transit that I think pre-16-year-old Americans don't have. In other words, there's an awkward age there between about 12 and 16 when really, most Americans really want to be with other kids their age, and yet they cannot drive yet. And so if they're really in the distant suburbs, they really feel a kind of confinement, even though it's open. But when there was a bus, as there was when I was growing up, it kind of broke that. So you could ride the bus and experience other neighborhoods on your own. And I noticed the way the neighborhoods changed. And, of course, they went from wealthy to poor, and they went from white to black. But then you get to Main Street, and there was an excitement about Main Street. And by the way, Elvis Presley was almost the same age, a little older. But this is the world he grew up in as well. And it was, when we say Main Street, I'm using it almost metaphorically for an entire downtown district. It might be four blocks wide and a dozen or so blocks long. So it was a pretty substantial area. Main Street's the most important. But there were four big department stores. There were five big movie theaters. There were all sorts of smaller kinds of stores and restaurants. It's difficult now to recapture how exciting it was to go downtown. It was unlike anything else you could experience for hundreds of miles in any direction, because the buildings were bigger, the sidewalks were crowded, the people were diverse and you'd never seen them before, and the stores were big, and it just had a tremendous impact on me. I used to skip school to go downtown and go see a movie or go to the library. So I felt that downtown or that Main Street was an extraordinarily liberating experience for someone who's growing up in a segregated city where they even had censorship, official censorship, in the 1950s.
You had four specific interests that you mentioned that caused you, upon occasion, to skip school, if you wish, and head to the Main Street. Without getting you into difficulty, let's maybe talk about each one, because I thought that was interesting as well. You mentioned toy soldiers.
Well, you know, one of the things I think is unusual about youngsters today is they don't go in for they go in for a kind of fantasy, you know, with Nintendo games and other kind of things, or things in the future. When I was growing up, we wanted realistic kinds of toys, so we had pistols that looked like real guns, and I suppose that that only an expert could have told the difference between the cap guns that we had and a real gun. Now, of course, we don't even allow that. But we also had real soldiers and guns, and I don't know whether this is a legacy of World War II or what, but every department store had a toy section, and every toy section had collections of toy soldiers, often inexpensive plastic kinds of things. But no department store I know of in the United States carries these things anymore. But it was absolutely common then, and I used to play with the toy soldiers with my friends, buying these little plastic things that cost 10 cents a soldier. Not so cheap, by the way, in the 1950s, but nevertheless inexpensive enough so that you could ultimately amass an army of several hundred members. I have continued with that interest, but now I get the hand-painted metal figures, and they're considerably more expensive.
Well, one sort of focal point for the struggle between urban and rural America has been the public library, and you mentioned that one of the four reasons you had for going downtown was to visit the public library.
Well, I always have loved books, and there were times that I would literally skip school and go to the library, both to read about the Civil War or to the cornucopia of volumes about, reference volumes and things like that. And I've often puzzled about that since then, to think of somebody skipping school so that you could go read. And I don't know if that's a reflection on me or on the teaching or something else, but I wanted to learn. What is amazing, though, as I think back about my childhood, as late as 1956, professors from what was then called Memphis State College were fired from their jobs for publicly protesting the fact that African Americans could not use the public library. I find that phenomenal, but what I found even more, I suppose, unflattering about myself is that I was unaware of that. I don't remember at the time that I used the public library or I rode the bus at the front of the bus being as concerned as I wish that I had been, that half the population of the city could not do the same things that I was doing.
Well, I'll wrap the next two into one. Perhaps you can answer them together. But you also went downtown for popular entertainment and for sex.
Well, what I was saying about popular entertainment, I think, is that was where the movies go. When you had a date or something like this, whereas now in most downtown America streets, it's often said you could shoot a gun down the street at 8 o'clock at night or a cannon and not hit anybody. But when I was growing up, if you really wanted to impress a young woman, you went downtown. You went to one of the big theaters. You wouldn't go to a neighborhood theater. And you dressed up for it, by the way. You wore a coat and tie. And she probably wore hose and heels and a dress and all that sort of stuff. So going downtown was going somewhere that was fancy. And it represented something to me. But the other thing about the sex, and I compared it favorably to a shopping mall, is that there were little places in Memphis. Again, I emphasize that it's a segregated city and a city with formal censorship in the 1950s. So you felt very much like there was this kind of invisible hand controlling everything. But there were stores in Memphis, and I remember the Fun Shop, which used to sell what they call wolf cards, which were pictures of women partially unclothed, or there would be a magazine store where they would sell naturist magazines, or what they call at the time nudist magazines, and these carried images which were otherwise totally unavailable in Memphis. And my friends and I would try to either buy the cards or go to the magazine stores before we were thrown out. But what I was really thinking about there is that there is an edge to downtown. There's a sense in which it's slightly scary. It's slightly, it's on the edge of what's acceptable and not acceptable. And I think that when you're a teenager and you're trying to find the boundaries of life, it's good to have that. And what I find objectionable about shopping malls, and I think shopping malls are about the most boring part of modern life, and I'm predicting here officially that in about 40 years they'll disappear. Is that they are so totally, they're such totally controlled environments where you quite literally could not sell a magazine that somebody else didn't approve, that you could not stay open all night. The wonderful thing about Main Street is it was filled with buildings of different ages and different functions, and one building would be older than another one, and so the rents on that building would be less than on another one, and so it allowed the opportunity for someone to start a new kind of a business. It's very difficult to start a business in a shopping mall because they're charging the same rate per square foot for your business as for the Gap or Banana Republic or whatever. And these big national chains can commit themselves to a five-year lease at a high per square foot charge that an ordinary person can't do. And so what I worry about is that we're kind of homogenizing the nation in a commercial sense by losing the old downtown Main Street kind of things. And so when I talked about the rise and fall of Main Street in Memphis, I really could have said exactly the same thing about virtually any downtown in the whole United States.
Afraid so. You use one example. We only have a minute left. But what happened to Beale Street, which was such a center 40, 50 years ago?
Well, Beale Street was the center of Black America. In fact, probably the most famous, probably as famous as any street, maybe even including 125th Street in Harlem in New York City, was Beale Street. It really was the center. Memphis is, even though it's in Tennessee, it's really part of that Mississippi Delta. So it's at least as much a part of Mississippi and Arkansas as it is of Tennessee. And Beale Street, and when you think of W.C. Handy and the blues, I mean, Beale Street has that connection. But I think one of the nice things about Beale Street was it hit Main Street at right angle, so it was perpendicular to Main Street. That's where Elvis Presley used to go to Lansky Brothers clothing store. Again, a place where the respectable sorts in Memphis would not have gone, but the beginning of a kind of a place where both blacks and whites might have shopped. And this was, like Main Street, a place of coming together. I remember going to a rock concert there in the 1950s. Now, probably it was segregated and all white when I went there, but nevertheless, it was a black theater. So in other words, there's some coming together, and there were black entertainers. And you have to realize about how totally segregated Memphis was in the 1950s to realize that even there, interaction was very rare. What happened to Beale Street was in the 1960s and the urban renewal craze, they essentially leveled the whole place. And for about 20 years, it was really fallow, and nothing much was going on there. But in the last 15 years or so, Beale Street has been reborn. And now there are a whole series of jazz places up and down the street, from Boogie Cafe, B.B. King's, all sorts of places like that, a new place for Elvis Presley. And so especially on Thursday, Friday, and Saturday nights, I think Beale Street does integrate the races, it integrates the ages, it integrates the sexes, it has wonderful music. And so I urge people who are passing through the Memphis area to try out Beale Street on a weekend night. It's quite exciting.
Okay. Well, at least we can end on a somewhat positive note there in the future of Beale Street in Memphis. So thank you for being with us today.
Well, it's been my pleasure, Brian, and thank you so much.
Great. You've been listening to Kenneth Jackson, Jacques Barzun Professor of History and the Social Sciences at Columbia University and one of the contributing authors to American Places. And this is Talking History.
Well, that's all right, Mama. That's all right with me. That's all right with Mama. Anywhere you want to be, well, that's all right. Well, that's all right.
Although not on Main Street, high on the list of Memphis, Tennessee's list of historic sites is the home of one of the nation's pop culture icons, Elvis Presley. Here to provide his perspective on Graceland is Joel Williamson, Lineberger Professor in the Humanities at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, and the author of Graceland in American Places.
Graceland was the home of Elvis Presley during the last 20 years of his life. For millions of people around the world, it has become a mecca. Every year now, 750,000 men, women, and children visit Graceland. Every August, on the evening of the anniversary of his death, thousands of the faithful celebrate his spirit in a candlelight procession through the house and grounds. Graceland provides a place where that spirit comes to earth. There is no place like Graceland in America. There is no Graceland for Frank Sinatra or Bing Crosby. Only the homes of George Washington and Thomas Jefferson draw more visitors. Everyone who loved Elvis believed that Elvis loved them. It was they who gave and still give power to an ever-evolving image of Elvis. He was notorious among fellow entertainers for finding and giving his audiences what they wanted. His image shifted as his audience shifted, from stage to television to film and back to stage again. Since his death in 1977, the Elvis image is contested, largely between those who want to make money out of the image and the fans, each of whom has his or her own uses for Elvis. At one level, Elvis and Graceland is the Beverly Hillbillies story all over again. It is country come to town, which is to say that it is the American story of the 20th century. Elvis did not build Graceland, nor even name it. It was built by Dr. and Mrs. Thomas Moore. Mrs. Moore descended from early and wealthy Memphians. She inherited the land from her Aunt Grace. In 1939 and 1940, she built an elegant house there and called it Graceland, after her beloved aunt. Dr. Moore built up a famous herd of purebred Hereford cattle at Graceland. When the Presleys moved in 1957, Mrs. Presley brought in her chickens, probably Rhode Island Reds. The Presleys also brought in 3 mobile homes, which they filled mostly with uncles, aunts, and cousins. The Presleys always referred to the house at Graceland as the mansion. The Moores never did so. The Clampetts got rich when oil was discovered on their Arkansas farm. The Presleys got rich when the world discovered Elvis's genius as an entertainer. It was totally fitting that in Hollywood, Elvis became intimate with the beautiful young woman who played Ellie Mae on The Hillbillies. After being with Elvis for a time, she realized that Elvis did not intend to marry her. She, like many before her, left Elvis. But Elvis was like that. He belonged to everyone and to no one. He represented your dreams. In this post-Civil War world, where horizons are dim and landmarks are fading, the need for dreams continues. So too Elvis. His body rests at Graceland, but his spirit is everywhere, and he will be whatever you want him to be.
You've been listening to Joel Williamson, author of The Crucible of Race, Black-White Relations in the American South Since Emancipation. This is Talking History.
Then I'm walking in Memphis, just walking with my feet 10 feet off a beam. Walking in Memphis, but do I really feel the way I feel? Saw the ghost of Elvis on Union Avenue. Followed him up to the gates of Graceland, and I watched him walk right through. Now security, they did not see him, they just hovered round his tomb. But there's a pretty little thing waiting for the king down in the jungle room. When I was walking in Memphis, I was walking with my feet 10 feet off a beam. Walking in Memphis,